hello and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast and the ongoing reading of my 2005 novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. If I sound a little muzzy and fuzzy, it's because I just got off an overnight flight from Toronto back to London. Yes, we're back home after 3 weeks away. And I have nice things to say about the airline, which is a rare thing, but we flew Air India, who I'd never flown before. They're relatively inexpensive. You can get a business class seat on Air India for what you'd pay for just the premium economy seat on British Airways. And they were incredibly nice to us. The plane was kind of old and a little run down and crummy, but it was perfectly serviceable. The beds weren't, they weren't really good enough to sleep in for me. I've got bad sciatica, so I didn't really sleep. I kind of sat up most of the night, but the baby slept like a baby. And they were really good to the kid and just really sweet and lovely. So if you're on a route serviced by Air India and you feel like going business, it's a lot cheaper than going premium economy on some of their competing airlines, and definitely worth checking out. An unpaid endorsement. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I finished Chicken Little, the novella I was writing, or a short story that turned into a novella that I wrote for the Frederick Pohl tribute anthology. Don't know if they'll take it yet. I haven't heard anything back from them, getting slightly nervous, but it weighed in at over 20,000 words, and I'm really actually happy with how it turned out. And my friend Emily Herson will be reading it for my short story collection with a little help. The audio for that collection has started to come in. I've got two of those now. And the rest due very shortly. And I am in crunch mode on For the Win. That's my my next novel. It's due on the 31st, which is 7 days hence. So I am just completely, not panicked, but definitely crunching to finish this damn book up. Anyway, that's enough. It's going to be a short podcast today because I've got 6 bags of books and random crap that I brought back from Canada that I need to taxi down to the office, as well as the dry cleaning and the shoes that need fixing. And then I'm going to come home and pick the baby up from daycare and start our lives again. Here's the reading. Trey's phone number was still current in the video store's database, so she called him. "Hey, Trey," she said, "it's Lara." "Lara, hey," he said, in a tone that left no doubt that he was picturing her in her panties. "Sorry, your bro ain't here. Want to take me out to dinner tonight?" The silence on the other end of the line made her want to laugh, but she bit her lip and rolled her eyes and amused the girl browsing the Chop Saki epics and visibly eavesdropping. "Trey, Lara, yes, I'd love to, sure. Is this like a group thing, or—" "No, Trey, I thought I'd keep this between the two of us. I'll be at the store until 6. Meet me here?" "Yeah, okay. Okay, sure, I'll see you tonight." Brad was so thin, he looked like a corpse. He was still tall, though, and his hair and beard were grown out into long, bad-smelling straggles of knot and grime. In the half-light of the garage, he had the instantly identifiable silhouette of a street person. He gathered Adam up in a hug that reeked of piss and booze, a hug like a bundle of twigs in his arms. "I love you," he whispered. Andrew backed away and held him at arm's length. His skin had gone to deep creases lined with soot, his eyes filmed with something that looked like pond scum. "Brady, what are you doing here?" He held a finger up to his lips, then opened the door again onto the now empty alley. Alan peered the way that Davy and Krishna had gone, just in time to see them turn a distant corner. "Give it another minute," Blake said, drawing the door nearly closed again. A moment later, they heard another door open, and then Kurt's chain-draped boots jangled past, headed the other way. They listened to them recede, and then Brian swung the door wide again. "It's okay now," he said. They stepped out into the sunlight, and Bert started to walk slowly away. Alan caught up with him, and Bert took his arm with long, bony fingers, leaning on him. He had a slight limp. "Where have you been?" Alan asked, when they had gone halfway home through deft, confident turnings, led by Blake. "Watching you," he said. "Of course. When I came to the city, I worked out at the racetrack for a week and made enough money to live off of for a couple months, and avoided the tough guys who watched me winning and waited to catch me alone at the streetcar stop. I made enough, and then I went to watch you." "I knew where you were, of course. always knew where you were. I could see you whenever I closed my eyes. I knew when you opened your shops, and I went by at night and in the busy parts of the day so that I could get a better sense of them. I kept an eye on you, Alan, watched over you. I had to get close enough to smell you and hear you and see you, though. It wasn't enough to see you in my mind. Because I had to know the why. I could see the what, but I had to know the why. Why were you opening your stores? Why were you saying the things you said? I had to get close enough because, from the outside, it's impossible to tell if you're winking because you've got a secret, or if you've got dust in your eye, or if you're making fun of someone who's winking, or if you're trying out a wink to see how it might feel later. It's been 4 years I've been watching you when I could, going back to the track for more when I ran out of money, and you know what? I know what you're doing. Alan nodded. Yeah, he said. You're watching. You're doing what I'm doing. You're watching them to figure out what they're doing. Alvin nodded. Yeah, he said. You don't know any more about the world than I do. Albert nodded. Yeah, he said. Billy shook his head and leaned heavily on Alan's arm. I want a drink, he said. I've got some vodka in the freezer, Alan said. I'll take some of the Irish whiskey in the sideboard in the living room. Alan looked at him sharply, and he shrugged and smiled an apologetic smile. I've been watching, he said. They crossed the park together, and Buddy stopped to look hard at the fountain. That's where he took Edward, right? I saw that. Yeah, Alvin said. Do you know where he is now? Yeah, Billy said. Gone. Yeah, Adam said. Yeah. They started walking now, Billy's limp more pronounced. What's with your leg? My foot. I lost a couple toes last year to frostbite and never got them looked at properly. He reeked of piss and booze. They didn't grow back? He shook his head. They didn't. Not mine. Hello, Krishna, he said. Alan looked at his neighbor's porch. Krishna stood there, stock still, against the wall. Friend of yours, huh? Krishna said. Boyfriend? He offered me a bottle of wine if I'd let him take me home, Bradley said. Best offer I had all week. Want to make it a threesome on, how you say, mange ma toit? Krishna contorted his face into an elaborate sneer. Puke, he said. Bye, Krishna, Buddy said. Alan put his key into the lock and let them in. Blaine made a hobbling beeline for the sideboard and picked up the Jim Beam Apollo 8 commemorative decanter that Alan kept full of Bushmills 1608 and poured himself a tall glass of it. He drank it back in two swallows, then rolled his tongue around his mouth with his eyes closed while he breathed out the fumes. "I've been thinking about that bottle ever since you bought it," he said. "This stuff is legendary. God, that's good. I mean, it's fucking magical." "It's good," Andrew said. "You can have more if you want." "Yeah," Burke said, and poured out another drink. He carried it and the decanter to the sofa and settled onto it. "Nice sofa," he said. "Nice living room. Nice house." "Not very normal, though." "No," Andrew said. "I'm not fitting in very well." "I fit in great." He drank back another glug of whiskey and poured out another $20 worth. "Just great. It's the truth. I'm totally invisible and indistinguishable. I've been sleeping at the Scott Mission for 6 months now, and no one has given me a second glance. They can't even steal my stuff, because when they try, when they come for my shoes or my food in the night, I'm always awake and watching them and just shaking my head." The whole living room stank of whiskey fumes with an ammoniac tinge. "What if I find you some clothes and a towel? Would I clean myself up? Would I get rid of this protective coloration and become visible again?" He drank more, breathed out the fumes. "Sure, why not? Why not? Time to be visible. You've seen me. Krishna's seen me. Davy's gonna see me. Least I got to see them first." And so he let his older brother lead him by the hand upstairs to the bathroom, with its damp swollen paperbacks and framed kitsch art potty training cartoons, and so he let his brother put him under the stinging hot shower and shampoo his hair and scrub him vigorously with a back brush, sluicing off the ground in grime of the streets. though the callous pads on his hands remained as dark with soot as the feet of an alley cat. And so he let his older brother wash the stumps of his toes where the skin was just a waxy pucker of scar, like belly buttons, which neither of them had. And so he let his brother trim away his beard, first with scissors, and then with an electric razor, and so he let his brother brush out his long hair and tie it back with an elastic taken from around a bunch of broccoli in the vegetable crisper, and so, by the time the work was done and he was dressed in two big clothes that hung over his sunken chest and spindly legs like a tent, he was quite sober and quite clean and quite different. "You look fine," Adam said, as Brent fingered his chin and watched the reflection in the full-length mirror on the door of Alan's study. "You look great." "I look conspicuous, visible. Used to be that eyes just slid off of me. Now they'll come to rest on me, if only for a few seconds." Alan nodded. "Sure, that's right. You know, being invisible isn't the same as being normal. Normal people are visible." "Yeah," Brad said, nodding miserably. He pawed again at the smooth hollows of his cheeks. "You can stay in here," Alan said, gesturing at his study. The desk and the laptop and his little beginning of a story sat in the middle of the room, surrounded by a litter of access points in various stages of repair and printed literature full of optimistic, non-technical explanations of ParasiteNet. "I'll move all this stuff out." "Yeah," Billy said, "you should. Just put it in the basement in boxes. I've been watching you screw around with that wireless stuff, and you know, it's not real normal either. It's pretty desperately weird. Danny's right. That Kirk guy following you around, it's like he's in love with you. That's not normal." He flushed, and his hands were in fists. "Christ, Adam, you're living in this goddamn museum and nailing these stupid science fair projects to the sides of buildings. You got this comet tail of druggy kids following you around, buying dope with the money they make off of the work they do for you. You're not just visible, you're strobing, and you're so weird even I get the crawlies around you." His bare foot slapped the shining, cool wood as he paced the room, lame foot making a different sound from the good one. Alan looked at the window at the green maple keys rattling in the wind. "They're buying drugs?" Benny snorted. "You're bankrolling weekly heroin parties at two warehouses on Oxford and three raves a month down on Liberty Street." He looked up at the ceiling. "Mimi's awake now," he said. "Better introduce me." Mimi kept her own schedule, mostly nocturnal, padding quietly around his house while he slept, coming silently to bed after he rose while he was in the bathroom. She hadn't spoken a word to him in more than a week, and he had said nothing to her, but for the snores and the warmth of the bed when he lay down, and the morning dishes in the sink, she might not have been living with him at all. But for his constant awareness of her presence in his room, and but for the shirts with cutaway backs in the laundry hamper, he might have been living all on his own. But for the knife that he found under the mattress, compass set into the handle, serrated edge glinting, he might have forgotten those wings, which drooped near to the floor now. Footsteps crossing between the master bedroom and the bathroom, pausing at the top of the stairs. A soft cough. "Alan?" "It's okay, Mimi," he said. She came down in a pair of his boxer shorts, with the top sheet complicatedly draped over her chest in a way that left her wings free. Their tips touched the ground. "This is my brother Bentley," Adam said. "I told you about him." "You can see the future," she said reproachfully. "You have wings," he said. She held out her hand and he shook it. "I want breakfast," she said. "Sounds good to me," Brent said. Alan nodded. "I'll cook."
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike, US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.